Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Hello, everyone. This is Joseph Paris, and welcome to this episode of State of Readiness, a fireside chat set with some business leaders from around the world. And with me today, I have Michael Rabbit, and Michael is the head of Business Transformation Office at the Argonne National Laboratory. He has over 30 years of experience in business operations and IT, including process improvement, project management, business analysis, and client services. As a Six Sigma Black Belt, he also established and co-leads Argonne's Lean Six Sigma Community of Practice. Michael formerly worked at Continental Insurance, CNA Insurance, and Sedgwick. Michael's civic and community engagement work includes several nonprofit organizations, one example being an affordable housing advocacy organization in Chicago that he co-founded. Michael's a graduate of Bradley University and holds an MBA from DePaul University. He's a native of St. Louis and currently lives in Chicago with his wife and two children. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Joe. Great to be here.
Yeah, awesome. I'm really glad that we're able to make this happen after some months of coordinating schedules and whatnot. And it's really, really a pleasure meeting you. Now, we met, I think, at BTOS a couple of years ago.
We did. It was at the 2018 conference, and you signed your book, and I enjoyed reading it.
Awesome. Awesome. Now, what does the Argonne National Laboratory do?
So Argonne is one of 17 national laboratories across the U.S. It is a national science and technology research center, and every one of the labs does something a little bit different, but Argonne is one of the more diverse labs in the U.S. It's multidisciplinary. Its roots go back to the Manhattan Project, actually, in 1946, so the first national lab. And when I say diverse, that means that Argonne encompasses things such as global energy research, high energy physics. We have some really advanced battery research that goes on here. We also have some world-class research facilities where we have visiting scientists and engineers and researchers from all over the U.S. and the world come to use our world-class facilities. So a couple of the better known ones are the Advanced Photon Source and then what we call the Argonne Leadership Computing Facility, which I think some listeners might be interested to know that we have some of the fastest supercomputers in the world at that facility. That's a curve that is hard to stay ahead of, especially competing with China today for the world's fastest supercomputer. But Argonne in 2022 will be rolling out a supercomputer called Aurora, which will be the fastest supercomputer in the world. So we had a big press conference here a few months ago. CEO of Intel was here. Energy Secretary Rick Perry was here. So pretty big splash and a lot of excitement here getting ready for the arrival of Aurora. So hopefully that gives you and folks a little bit of a flavor for the amazing things that go on here.
That really sounds fascinating. Now, you have, not everybody can just, walk in and become a researcher there. I mean, I'm sure there's a protocol and you have to pretty much be invited, I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, there's an application process for visiting users. And then on the employee side, we have 3,200 employees and a lot of those folks start out, as students. We have a lot of students here this summer right now on campus, which is a really exciting thing to have. We have a lot of postdocs that come in. A lot of different entry points in as part of that pipeline of growing our talent here at Argonne.
Awesome. That's awesome. So, Michael, what was it like to be an OpEx professional in insurance and go to research? I mean, you're going from, the private sector to the public sector. What kind of challenges or opportunities or shocks might have you had?
Well, it's definitely a big change. I'd say, on a couple of fronts. One, just it's a different culture. Private sector, as many people know, moves a lot faster. There's different types of demands from, shareholders and other stakeholders. So things move a little bit slower here, so that's a challenge. I tend to be kind of impatient by nature. I want to get things done quickly, and so I've had to kind of learn how to operate within a different culture. The other thing is, while subject matter expertise isn't always crucial for OPEX leaders, there is always a natural tendency to really want to understand the business, right? I always prided myself on having my roots from being in the business, on the business side, coming up through operations. So there's always that tendency to want to present yourself as an expert. And so coming here, not having, science and research background, just being an OPEX professional, there was that learning curve, right? So just adding a few extra steps on the learning curve, on top of, any transition to any new job, obviously is a learning curve. But when you add the fact that it's a totally different, industry and you're going from private sector to public sector, that adds a little bit to that learning curve for sure.
So was there any, other than learning curve, was there any particular challenges that you had to overcome? I mean, you mentioned the, having a different gear ratio, private sector yep. versus public sector. Was there, cultural challenges, any technical challenges that, I would imagine being a research facility, it's got the latest and greatest technology, at your disposal. But, were any of those, challenges apparent? Cause it sounds so far that, it wasn't too, awful different from the private sector.
Yeah, no, I mean, people are people, right? And processes are processes. The challenge again is more on the cultural side. The fact that, my group was a startup operation and, a lot of folks here at Argonne are long-term employees. People with long memories of when things maybe didn't work so well before. And so we're on a journey, as you talk about in your book, to get to a state of readiness, and we are not there, right? So we're in a change mode. We're trying to prepare the organization for that. And there's a lot of resistance to change, which is why, one of the things that I put pretty high on my to-do list was to build out an org change management capability here, because I knew that we were going to need that to overcome some of the resistance to change that's just really baked into the culture.
That's amazing. When you're in the private sector, you're clients facing roles and opportunities are more, less different than, at a research facility. Cause, you think about insurance, you have people that are, always, facing the customer, servicing the customer. There's, yep. transactions all the time. Yep. I don't suppose that level of transactional interfacing with the outside world, i.e. the, the customer in this case, is as intense, but what, might replace that, type of interfacing and interaction?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. When I was on the insurance side, one of my roles was very direct client facing as a client service director, and for some Fortune 500 companies. Certainly look at the customer differently. Primarily, it's internal customers, right? So, on the operations right. side, what we call laboratory operations, our job is to service the entire employee base here so that our brilliant researchers can focus on doing great science. And more broadly, of course, you look at Department of Energy. We're a Department of Energy contractor, so they're clearly a customer and with their own set of demands. We're managed by the University of Chicago, so we also view them as a customer that provides governance and oversight. So it's definitely very different, different set of challenges. But at the end of the day, when you're doing OPEX work, you still think about your customer in the same terms, right? What is it that they value? What is the output that you're looking to deliver and optimize?
Yeah. So I hate to keep on hammering on this public versus private, but there's from the outsider. I've never worked for the public sector. You know, the only thing I see is what's on TV and how people think that government is so inefficient and so on. When you got into Argonne, you know, were there any challenges with respect to, say, you know, core values or, you know, the culture of leadership or any of those, you know, items that I would imagine are different?
Yeah. So you mentioned core values. So one of the first things I asked about when I joined here was, what are our core values? Where do I find them? And I was having a discussion with the head of our leadership institute here, and she said, well, we don't have any. And she says, that's something that I've actually been advocating for. And the exciting thing is that within the last year, Argonne has had an initiative where we've established our core values. And so that's really a great thing. We still have a little way to go in that journey. We're trying to distill those into, you know, specific behaviors. It's very much linked into our diversity and inclusion initiative, which is something that, you know, I'm very passionate about. And so it's an exciting time to be here with a lot of doing a lot of different things between D&I work and the core values and the org change management. There's a lot of focus on the culture and the people side of the business here, which is crucial.
You mentioned you know, diversity and inclusion, and you know, I'm on the board of a university in the States there, and I'm attached to the system science and industrial engineering department, and you know, one of the challenges that I have, because we're always looking at this, you know, diversity, you know, how do we get if I look at the student body, 25% of the student body is female, probably less, you know, in this particular department. And you know, how do we get, you know, obviously then you're only graduating, you know, 25% females. Okay. You know, how do we get diversity, you know, at the employment level, at your, you know, at the same, you know, say lab, you know, cause it just stands to reason that the employment, demographic would be 25% female. So, you know, how do we, you know, there's a big push for, you know, diversity and inclusion, you know, but if the people aren't being graduated, how do you think we get there?
Well, and that's definitely a challenge here. We face a similar challenge, and a lot of it is about the pipeline and starting early. There's a lot of great programs. We have an educational program group here that focuses very much on early career folks, bringing students in early, getting them exposed to STEM. And part of it is also just casting a wide enough net. You know, one of the things I've noticed here in Argonne, based on our location, I worked downtown Chicago most of my career. We're out here in the burbs, and a lot of folks that work here are, you know, Chicago's a tough commute depending on where you live. And so a lot of folks are in the surrounding suburbs here. And I'm a believer that, you know, Chicago's a really big place, very diverse metropolitan area. We really need to be making sure that we are recruiting people from all over Chicago, and we're finding ways to get them here. And I think that will do a lot for increasing diversity. But, you know, it's clearly got, it needs to be a multi-pronged effort. Those are just a couple things that I think, you know, people need to focus on.
You know, reading, you know, your, the intro here earlier today, you know, I couldn't help but notice, you know, how, you know, you obviously, for lack of a better term, believe charity begins at home. You know, in other words, you know, not just in the four walls of your domicile, you know, actually where you live, but, you know, your active engagement in the community and in civic endeavors, and that you have founded an affordable housing advocacy organization in Chicago. I mean, so obviously you have interests that are deeply felt, I mean, passionate about. Can you talk to me a little bit about that journey?
Definitely. So giving back to the community is extremely important to me, as you noted. And it's also something I think, you know, for business leaders or anybody in an organization, it's a great way to learn and grow. you know, people are always looking for development opportunities and just being exposed to different community groups who, you know, from particularly from a diversity standpoint, maybe look at things a different way, maybe have different ways of running meetings, different ways of organizing people, collaborating. You know, I've learned so much just from being involved in that way. And, you know, I think it's also, you know, just part of looking at your community from the standpoint of all the different social determinants of healthy communities, right? So affordable housing is one of those things, but I'm also, you know, very passionate about, you know, education, you know, police relations with the community. How do we address, you know, healthcare disparities among different groups within the community? So I try to look at the kind of the big picture there, and it's just really something that I think it's also a great opportunity for companies, you know, to partner with communities on these types of initiatives.
So, you know, I can't help but think that, you know, with all of the activity that you have going on, you know, obviously, you've given that this is mostly volunteer work. Working with other volunteers, you can't have an autocratic leadership style. So, I'm guessing from your being so humble that you fully embrace or supportive of, or maybe I shouldn't even say that, maybe just part of who you are, servant leadership is ingrained in your DNA.
Definitely. So I definitely identify or self-identify with as being a servant leader. It's part of my philosophy of leading teams, of working within an organization. I think, you know, it's important for people to understand that, you know, I work for them as much as they work for me in terms of my direct reports. And I think it's just the right way to lead people today. You know, I think it ties into all the things we've talked about so far in terms of core values and diversity and inclusion. And so, yeah, I agree. I think it's a very apt title for my philosophy.
So, now you're the head of Business Transformation Office. But you didn't start off as the head of anything, right? I mean, you know, how many people have you worked for in your career? And, what are those people that you reported to? What kind of influence did they have?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because I've done so many different things over my career that I actually stopped to think about it a few months ago. And I think I counted up maybe 23 different managers in about a 30-year career. So, the great thing about that is, you know, it's a lot of change, not a lot of stability is one way to look at it, but I've looked at it as a great opportunity to learn from so many different leadership styles. So, you know, from a mentoring standpoint, I've maybe had a couple more formal mentors. One was as part of a leadership development program early in my career. But for the most part, you know, I've not had formal mentoring. So it's been kind of up to me to try to learn from as many different leaders as I can through observations, through asking questions, developing relationships. And, you know, if I look at those 23 or so folks, they're all different, right? And they all had different leadership styles. And I could probably point to maybe one or two things that I learned from each one of those folks.
You know, it's interesting. A couple of episodes ago, I made the comment about stealth mentorship. You know, most mentors, you know, the predominant number of mentors in our lives, don't even know they're mentors. You know, they don't even know they're mentoring. You know, there's, you know, sometimes when you come on board to a new company or you're indoctrinated into some new product line or some new department, there's a mentor that onboards you. But there's very few people that actually find and seek an official mentor who knows that they're an actual mentor. You know what I mean? They might be mentors to us, but they don't know it. Is that your finding? Or, I mean, the people that you mentioned that you took one or two things from each, Did they know they're mentoring you?
I don't think so. I think you're right. I think in most cases they were stealth mentors, right?
Yeah.
I think we need a mix of approaches, right? So that's another thing I'm interested in doing here with the diversity and inclusion group within the directorate I work in. We've had some discussions around how do we create perhaps a mentoring program for folks here. There's some mentoring that goes on the research side, but for operations folks, there really isn't anything there. So we're looking at, I'm excited about the opportunity to do some of that. But I think it's always going to be a mix of, you know, formal, informal, stealth, if you will. But the important thing is that people, you know, have the opportunity to learn and grow, whether they have to take the initiative for it or somebody else is looking out for them.
Yeah, thank you for that. So we're going to take a break, and then we'll be right back in a few moments. With me today is Michael Rabbit, who's the head of Business Transformation Office at Argonne National Laboratory, and this is Joe Paris.
This episode of State of Readiness, sponsored by the Operational Excellence Society, a think tank, a creator and aggregator of knowledge and know-how, serving businesses and professionals who wish to learn more on the various topics which combined comprise the discipline of operational excellence. Learn more at www.opexsociety.org.
Welcome back. I'm Joseph Paris, and with me is Michael Rabbit, who's head of Business Transformation Office at the Argonne National Laboratory. So, Michael, how did you get into continuous improvement in operational excellence? You know, I'm looking at your studies, and I just have that you graduated from Bradley. I don't know what degree you held, and of course you did go and earn an MBA. But still, with MBAs, you know, there's not usually a direct leap to continuous improvement in operational excellence. So, can you sort of walk me through that part of the journey? How did you get to be in this field at all?
Sure. Yeah, so my major at Bradley was Operations Management Information Systems. And coming out of college, like a lot of folks, I really didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. So I started working in insurance, focused mostly on the claims side of the business, and got into to management, operations management, and then client services. So I was working with, Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 type clients, really enjoyed that work. I thought that was a pretty good career path, figured maybe that's what the career path I would stay on. But I think one of the themes of my career is I've been willing to take risks and try something different. And so I had an opportunity where at CNA, they were starting up a Six Sigma program. Now back then, Dating things here a little bit. Back then, the whole lean part hadn't quite merged with Six Sigma. But so what they wanted to do was start off with this inaugural class of black belts. And so there was a nomination process for that. I was nominated by my department. And, you know, I'd always been one of these folks that enjoyed working on special projects. So, you know, different departments would say, hey, we need somebody to be on this project team. And I often would volunteer for it or get appointed to it. And so I really started to that part of the work was appealing to me. So being somewhat competitive, I said, you know, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring and see if I can get into this Six Sigma thing. It sounds fascinating. Didn't know a whole lot about it. So, you know, long story short, after having to go through a pretty rigorous interview process, I was selected as one of the dozen folks that would go through the black belt training, got trained by Duran Institute, and started doing project work from there. It wasn't long after that before, we expanded a bit, and I ended up being the point person in the main primary Six Sigma liaison to our chief claim officer, and continued to do the work from there. We eventually lost our sponsorship, and our group was eventually merged into the IT organization, which was my entree into that world. That's not something I really chose, didn't have any kind of a technical background, but turned out to be a great opportunity because it really rounded out my skill set.
It is dating you a bit, about Lean and Six Sigma not being merged yet. I remember, early 2000s, you had vicious debates about Lean versus Six Sigma. And, you know, they're, you know, almost two different religions. And it took a long time for those two words to become, or phrases to become, Lean Six Sigma, not just in words, but in reality. And I still see posts on LinkedIn every once in a while. It's like, you know, why Lean or Six Sigma is better than the other? And it just really kind of, you know, befuddles me. So when did you see the convergence of those two disciplines? Do you remember, or was it just a natural progression?
No, I do kind of remember. So you mentioned early 2000s, so it was 2001 that I went through the training and got my black belt certification. And, you know, eventually I started doing other things. Like I said, I moved into IT, and so I really wasn't doing hands-on Six Sigma work for a while. And but I remember just kind of paying attention to things, started hearing Lean Six Sigma. So I noticed that, you know, at some point those two had merged in many circles. And then when I came here to Argonne and established the Lean Six Sigma community practice and we put some folks through green belt training here, you know, it was at that point kind of brushed up on some of the history of that. And as you noted, it not everybody you know, kind of came together right away, but it seems like there's a pretty strong consensus now that's a very synergistic and complementary marriage, if you will.
Yeah. Fascinating. So we're going to get into the speed round questions. I'm going to ask you a couple of semi-random questions, and hopefully you'll have a quick response to it. The first one I'm going to share with you, first question I'll pose to you, I should say, is what's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
It's never stop learning and growing. I mean, you know, we all sometimes have a tendency to think that when I get a certain degree or when I get to a certain point in my career, I'm all set. And that's not true, right? The more you learn, the more you realize what you don't know, and that motivates me to continuously learn.
So just out of curiosity, who gave you that piece of advice? Do you remember?
You know, I don't remember. But it was early and often. I mean, I heard it more than once, so it definitely stuck with me.
So who's the one leader you look up to most, and why?
It's not a business leader. It's a world leader, and it's Pope Francis. I really admire him because he's taking on a huge challenge. We talk about institutions that need to change. The institution that he leads has some serious challenges and requires a lot of structural change. And I really admire the way he's going about it. I mean, I think the verdict is still out on how successful he's going to be. And he's not been perfect in his efforts, but I really admire his leadership style. I think, you know, he embodies certain servant leadership, certainly. And so definitely look up to him quite a bit.
Yeah. I would agree with you that, you know, it's a big organization, right? It spans the world. It's not completely tightly knit, you know, from a business administrative perspective. Like if you're General Motors, you know, there's a really tight hierarchy and reporting and communication protocol that exists. And it's not so much so, you know, in the Catholic Church. And what I think people don't understand is culture change is a lot of effort. You know, what people, you know, and this is of course just, you know, all my opinion, but, you know, a person, an individual, as in this case Pope Francis is, you know, the culture change, it spans the globe. You know, it's almost like one person at a time. And I think sometimes, you know, the general populace is impatient with, you know, unrealistically impatient with, you know, the rate of change that might take place. I mean, just even look in our, you know, our own federal government or any government anywhere, you know, to get a mindset to change takes a long time. And I think that I often share that people have to be, you know, when we're change agents, you know, I would consider myself one, and I certainly consider yourself one. You know, we have to be, and we have to understand that we're water on the rock. The rock will succumb to the water, but it's just going to take a lot of time and consistency. But we will wear it down eventually.
Yep. Yep.
So what's a personal habit that contributes to your success?
I'm going to say preparation. You know, I'm a big believer in particularly meetings, you know, just covering all the angles, preparing for all the possibilities, looking at all the risks. How are things going to flow? What are the desired outcomes? Kind of thinking two steps ahead. I guess I can thank my father for teaching me to play chess at an early age. People have said that I, you know, tend to always be thinking two steps ahead. So I just don't think you can ever overprepare.
Yeah. And not only just two steps ahead, but the variables involved in those two steps. Yeah.
Yep.
And last question, we'll call this a trivial pursuit question. What, you know, strange factoid would you like to share with the audience?
Well, one, I guess, quirky type story that I often share with people, and people seem to find it interesting, is when I was very young, I think maybe 12, maybe 13. I'm from, as you noted in the opening, I'm from St. Louis. Even though I live in Chicago, I'm still a huge and loyal St. Louis Cardinals baseball fan. And also, by the way, I'm still celebrating the St. Louis Blues Stanley Cup championship, which was a long time coming.
Yeah, where did that come from, right? I mean, Boston Bruins, like, that was amazing. Awesome.
Yeah, it was. We've been waiting a long time, 52 years for our first cup. And the thing is, the Blues have always been a great franchise. They made the playoffs 41 of their 52 years, but just something always, you know, always happened. That's why they called it a jinx or a curse. But back to the story and the Cardinals. So Lou Brock, one of the Hall of Famer star player for the Cardinals, was baseball's stolen base king. He set the single season stolen base record of 118 in 1974. And then in 1977, he was approaching Ty Cobb's career stolen base record. So one of the things that the Cardinals organization did was that they had this contest, and they called it "When Will Lou Do It?" And they would hand out these forms at games, you know, kind of like the way they used to hand out all-star ballots before that all went online. And they asked fans to fill out this form for this contest and predict, you know, this was back in May, and, you know, he was projected to maybe break the record in July or so. So I filled this thing out and kind of waited to the last minute, like the deadline, before I turned it in. And it was a good thing I did, because he kind of was off to a slow start that year. And so I was able to kind of look and see what his trend was. And so, you know, to just kind of bring this to closure, I ended up winning the grand prize. I ended up picking the date that he set the record, the inning. They had all these tiebreakers, you know, you had to pick project the minute. I ended up got a direct hit on the exact minute that he stole the base. I predicted the score of the game, and then I was about 1,000 off on the attendance. So I messed that part up, I guess, but, it was a great story. I got the grand prize was season tickets, box seat season tickets for the following season. You could pick a road trip for a weekend trip to anywhere the Cardinals were playing the next year. I picked LA because I'd never been to California at that point in my life. So that's the quirky story.
That's awesome. I mean, I'm just trying to think of what are the odds. I mean, maybe that's what set you on your Six Sigma path. I mean, at the age of 10. Awesome.
Well, right? It was using data, you know, it wasn't just like, yeah, I just randomly threw some numbers in there. I mean, I thought about, you know, okay, if I'm going to pick the seventh inning, what time of the game would that probably be? If he did it in San Diego, you know, what attendance do they usually have that time of the year? So yeah, it was fun.
So it wasn't even a home game. It was an away game?
It was an away game, yeah, unfortunately.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, he didn't do it in front of the home fans. But then he came back the next time they were home. I was they announced that I had won at before the game, and I got to meet Lou Brock on the field and the commissioner of baseball and all that kind of stuff. Pretty exciting stuff for a 12-year-old kid.
Amazing. That's amazing. Well, thank you very much for joining me here today on State of Readiness. It's been a real pleasure having you and learning about your journey. Awesome. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Joe.
And I appreciate everything you do for the Operational Excellence Society, and learned a lot from reading your book, and look forward to staying in touch.
Very good. Very good. Well, thank you very, very much. Michael Rabbit, again, thank you very much. Business Transformation Office, the head of that at the Argonne National Laboratory. This is Joseph Paris, State of Readiness, signing off. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.